Midnight Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, an investigative report finds that Wisconsin is one of the most unfriendly states for whistleblowers. Our guest tells us that protections have been weakened for state employees who want to sound the alarm on waste and fraud.
First, amid escalating tensions with North Korea, the U.S. Air Force could be poised to put its fleet of B-52 nuclear-armed bombers back on 24-hour ready alert. That's a status that hasn't been used since the end of the Cold War.
And it's important to stress that the order to roll out the bombers hasn't come yet, but our next guest says officials are now undergoing preparations to be ready for such an announcement.
Marcus Weisgerber joins us now. He's the global business editor for Defense One and broke this story over the weekend. Marcus, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, there's been in some of the repeating of your reporting and other outlets, it seems like there's some confusion in what exactly is going on. Can you spell out for us what you reported on?
Sure. So a lot of people took our report as actually the bombers have been put on alert. They haven't been put on alert yet. But what is happening now is I spent last week with General David Goldfein. He's the U.S. Air Force Chief of Staff, so he's the top general in the Air Force. What he did is over a course of 6 days went to four military bases across the United States, and actually, specifically, these bases are focused on the nuclear mission, so nuclear war if it should happen. They have ICBMs and nuclear bombers and warheads and missiles and stuff at these bases. And one of the things they're doing down at Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana, where it's a B-52 base, is they're updating an alert site. And alert sites became real popular during the Cold War. It's where the air crews of planes like B-52s would sleep, and the planes would be parked outside with their missiles loaded up and ready to go. And if the president should send an order that they need to actually launch to go launch those missiles at Russia, they would run outside, jump in their planes, and take off at a moment's notice. Now, the planes were taken off that status back in 1991. Then President Bush took them off that status. However, right now, those alert sites are actually being brought back to life. They're doing many improvements. They're installing beds, and they're installing TVs and pool tables and stuff just for where people would sit, because they've been largely dormant for the past 30-ish years. So right now, the plan is not to put the B-52s on alert. We stress in our story that the order had not been given. But what they're going to do is there's a nuclear command plane. It's known as the Doomsday Plane. It's the E-4B Night Watch, and it's essentially a flying version of the Pentagon. And that would transmit the nuclear codes. There's always one of these planes on alert somewhere in the United States. And the immediate plan in the coming weeks and months is for those planes to actually start setting alert. But the B-52 alert, they're making the improvements. So should they get told, hey, can you put the B-52s on alert? They have the facility and infrastructure in place to do so.
Is there any indication of why they're doing it now? As you say, we haven't used this status since 1991. Are there any particular threats in mind here?
Well, one thing I kept hearing throughout the entire week was talk of North Korea and the threats that they've been making against the United States. And also, to a lesser extent, that Russia is also making many improvements to its nuclear weapons programs, and that the United States perceives Russia now as a credible threat, existential threat. One of the things that General Goldfein kept stressing is the military is in the process of buying new intercontinental ballistic missiles. The intercontinental ballistic missiles that are in the United States have been on alert for decades throughout the Cold War. They're buying new ones. They're also buying new nuclear cruise missiles. General Goldfein, one of the big questions he kept asking all week to the airmen and crews he was meeting was, can we actually speed up the process of getting new ones? Because the new ones aren't supposed to be done till mid to late next decade, so the mid-2020s, late-2020s.
How important a part of our nuclear arsenal are nuclear weapons delivered by plane, as opposed to those missiles you just mentioned or via nuclear submarines?
So they're three legs of the triad, and they're all, if you talk to senior military officials, they're all very important. I actually went on a trip last month with Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis up to Minot Air Force Base. It's one of the ICBM bases, and it has nuclear bombers. It has B-52s there as well. But one of the things he stressed was that the military officials feel all three legs of the so-called nuclear triad, that's the bombers, the ICBMs, and the submarines, are valid going forward. And right now, actually, when the Trump administration came in, they launched a study, and they're basically looking at what the right nuclear, what the right makeup of nuclear forces looks like in the future. And the results of that study are expected later this toward the end of this year, early next year. But again, as Secretary Mattis said, that all three legs, the bombers, the ICBMs, and the submarines, will remain.
We're talking to Marcus Weisgerber. He's with Defense One, and he wrote about nuclear bombers. Some preparations are being made in the event that they would have to go on 24-hour alert. Again, contrary to some reporting by other outlets, they are now not currently on alert. The Air Force, a spokeswoman for the Air Force, responded to your report saying there have been no plans or preparations to put the bombers back on 24-hour alert. What is your response, Marcus, to their response?
Well, you know, as we said in the story, the alert order had not been given, but clearly the Air Force. I went through this alert facility, which has been like I said, largely dormant since 1991. Improvements are very clearly underway at it. Now, again, are the B-52s going to be put on alert immediately? No, but again, the military as one defense official at the Pentagon told me last night, the military is all about contingency and all about planning. Of course, we're going to be looking to come up with ways to be prepared should we be asked to do something.
In an interview with Fox News over the weekend, President Trump had this to say about North Korea in particular.
We're prepared for anything. We are so prepared like you wouldn't believe. You would be shocked to see how totally prepared we are. Wow. If we need to be. Would it be nice not to do that? The answer is yes. Will that happen? Who knows?
So is doing something like this with the nuclear bombers and having it be out there that, hey, yeah, we're getting a little more ready to use them on short notice if need be, could this be seen as part of a message along with what the president is saying to North Korea when it comes to nuclear deterrence?
Sure. This is just one in a series of steps to show that the U.S. military, you know, is ready. I think one of the key things impressed upon me last week was that is specifically for the nuclear mission. Now, the military itself is very ready. They regularly talk about readiness levels. And remember, the military has been fighting for 15, 16 years in Iraq, Afghanistan. But the military is very prepared for a conventional type of war, that's a non-nuclear weapons war. What they're doing now is part of the being even more ready. They're buying all this new equipment. And I'll share with you a quick aside. Friday night we were in Montana. We were at Malmstrom Air Force Base, and that's another one of those ICBM bases. And we went down under the ground to where two young airmen sit, and they would be the ones to actually input the nuclear codes and turn the keys to actually launch the missiles. A lot of the equipment down there is incredibly old. There have been stories written over the years about how they use floppy disks, and they actually do use floppy disks. They're getting rid of the floppy disks. They're upgrading to scanned thumb drive type disk or scan disks. But one thing that I took away specifically was that a lot of the defense companies that actually names were imprinted on these, like the switches themselves, don't even exist anymore.
And as you talked to officials here, there was some talk of use of nuclear weapons in a non-nuclear war scenario, a nuclear weapon aspect to a conventional war. Is that right?
Yeah. So one of the things General Goldfein did talk about was the notion of actually having a conventional war with a nuclear power, basically being able to have a war without resorting to going nuclear. It's one of the many challenges he's posed throughout the week to all these airmen he encountered. The military is looking at ways to use deterrence. In the past, they had, it was the U.S. and Russia. That's it. Now you have other players involved. You have North Korea involved and making provocative threats. A war with North Korea would probably look different than a war with Russia. However, what is the Pentagon doing? It's buying new ICBMs, new submarines, and new bombers and new nuclear cruise missiles. It's basically doing exactly the same thing it had done for just that, with that one different nuclear, when it just had one primary rival. He's encouraging people to think about doing things differently. And, just because we've always done it like this for the last 50 or so years doesn't mean this is the right way to proceed going forward. And deterrence in the 21st century looks very different than it might have back then.
Very briefly, Marcus, as we wrap up, what's it like to be reporting from under, a nuclear missile silo?
Well, I'll tell you, it's very sobering when you go down the elevator and there you know, there's a 4-foot thick blast door. If you thought the bank safe door was thick, it's nothing compared to what's down there. The one thing is, the morale actually shocked me, of the morale of the airmen who sit down there. It actually shocked me about how proud they were of the mission they had, even though, you know, they always say, the day we have to do our job is the worst day the Earth has ever experienced. So they take their mission all very, very seriously.
Marcus, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Marcus Weisgerber is the global business editor for Defense One. He joined us to talk about why the Air Force could be poised to put its fleet of B-52 nuclear-armed bombers back on 24-hour ready alert.
First, when financial waste or fraud is uncovered in a governmental agency, whistleblowers are often the ones sounding the alarm. However, if their tips put a stop to abusive practices, they can still face retaliation from their employer. And a new report finds that it's especially true in Wisconsin.
Governor Walker has made it a priority to reduce waste and theft in the state government, but a series of court cases and legislative moves in recent years have eroded protections for those looking to voice their concerns. It's led some to call Wisconsin one of the worst states in the country for whistleblowers.
Dee Hall is a co-founder of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism and serves as the managing editor. The center's new series is called Broken Whistle. Dee, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
Let's go through, this series a little bit. Having someone within an organization, you know, providing tips on potential abuse is kind of at the center of what being a whistleblower is. People keeping their eyes open, making sure that things are running smoothly, and then taking the steps to report it in the event that, you know, something is going wrong. But looking at the big picture, you know, just how important are whistleblowers?
Well, what we found is that whistleblowers are the number one way to identify if you really are out to get rid of waste, fraud, and abuse in government or in a private company, for that matter. Whistleblowers are going to be your most likely source of information, much more than audits or any other kind of method that you might have, any kind of anti-fraud method you have. Sort of the one-off whistleblower is actually the most effective way to find out what's going on.
I would imagine, yeah, because they are in the organization day to day. It's not just a surprise audit. It's they can take notes, follow what's going on, anything like that. And Governor Walker has made the reduction of fraud in state agencies pretty much a top priority. But how has what he has been trying to achieve run counter to how whistleblowers are treated in the state?
Well, it's not entirely his fault about how whistleblowers are treated, and mostly because there have been a couple of recent court decisions that have really narrowed the path for a person to get retaliation from or to avoid retaliation after they blow the whistle. It's very difficult to meet the letter of the law right now, according to the attorneys who represent whistleblowers. The governor has made it a huge priority to try to get rid of waste, fraud, and abuse in state government. And what we found was that according to the governor, has saved taxpayers like $150 million when it comes to Medicaid and food share alone. So definitely there is activity. Fraud, waste, fraud, and abuse is being identified. But we found this effort at rooting it out is pretty unevenly distributed. It focuses a lot on programs that help people who are unemployed, people who are disabled, people who get food share, Medicaid, and other areas in which businesses, for example, might have to pay a penalty for defrauding the government. Those efforts have been weakened somewhat over the last several years.
And can you go a little bit more in depth in that? Because in the series, you look at, you know, loans that have been given out with the promise of job creation, stuff like that. And when they don't meet those standards, they're not held to the same regard.
Right. So what we found was when the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation has given out loans for job creation, when the businesses don't meet those promises, they are often allowed to repay the money, pennies on the dollar. On the other side of the coin, we have people who are providing services under Medicaid, private nurses, for example. They're providing the services. They're actually meeting what they're supposed to do, what they're getting paid for. But because of paperwork errors, at least this is what their advocates are saying, because of paperwork errors, they are being asked to forfeit tens of thousands of dollars in salary in Medicaid funding because of those alleged errors.
as this series has gotten underway, the big focus has been on whistleblowers. And you said that, you know, there have been a series of cases that have made it all the way up to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. I'd like to take a look at one of those. Dan Bethards was one person that you followed with this. Can you tell his story?
So back in 2012, Dan Bethards became aware that one of his supervisors, or his supervisor at the Department of Justice, was making and selling firearms. And Bethards, who is a federally licensed firearm dealer, knew that the boss did not have the license that he, Bethards, thought he should have had. So he reported that to both his supervisor above this individual, as well as the head of the Human Resources Department.
And what happened?
Well, he had been on medical leave. They left him on medical leave. At one point, he came back from medical leave, and they instantly suspended him. He eventually got fired in 2013. The federal government did actually investigate ATF, the Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives Bureau, did actually investigate and decided not to prosecute or levy any charges against this DOJ supervisor.
With the Dan Bethards case, it was pretty long, drawn out. You know, he paid a pretty big penalty, not just professionally, but personally. He's obviously won case, but what kind of message does what happened with Dan Bethards send to other people who might be keeping their eyes open for issues in their own departments?
Well, he certainly says he regrets doing it. He lost his home to foreclosure. He has not been able to get a job again, except for a brief stint back in law enforcement, which actually had been in for a long, long time. And so he does regret blowing the whistle. So he's a person who, I guess his story is a cautionary tale. In court, it turned out that he lost his case because he had notified the director of human resources, who is not in his supervisory chain. And on that that point alone, he was not able to prevail in proving that he was retaliated against.
Yeah. And so in Bethard's case, he, under best intentions, reached out to his HR person and tried to do what he needed to do. That is not also unusual. There are other cases in this series that basically kind of show the same thing, that people who have an issue with something happening in their department tell someone that something is happening and they don't meet the requirements. I guess on that front, can we talk about Joelle Shiger?
So she also was at the Department of Justice several years ago. She reported that she was afraid that the DOJ was about to violate either rule or law, I don't recall which, by having a security detail for the then Attorney General, J.B. Van Hollen, go up to Minnesota and provide security for him at the Republican National Convention. Her fear was that, you know, not only would the agency look bad, but they may have been violating some of the rules of the department. And so she notified her supervisors of that. But it was found, it went all the way up to the state Supreme Court, and they ruled, it was a split decision, but they ruled that because this was information that her supervisors already knew, she was not providing them information that they didn't know, and so she couldn't get protection from retaliation. In addition, it was the justices deemed that what she had offered was simply an opinion about this and not extra information that would protect her from retaliation. And so she lost that case.
So it sounds like there's a pretty narrow path that you have to take to become the perfect whistleblower. I mean, doesn't this make it all the more difficult for people to call out waste and fraud?
I think it does, based on talking to attorneys who represent whistleblowers, that they really can't. It's very difficult to see what the path forward is for people. Even if they research the issue and try to do it the right way, sometimes they may not qualify for protection from retaliation.
And what kind of retaliation have we seen in these cases?
So the retaliation goes anywhere from, you know, being assigned a task that, you know, is not, you know, within the area of expertise of a person, being, put into move to another location that they don't want to work out of, to being demoted, to being fired. Also, you know, we've had cases where people have said that they were left out of management meetings that they should be part of. So it's kind of a range of things that people will allege. But it's essentially the way the state law works is any adverse employment action that happens to you within 2 years after blowing the whistle could be considered an adverse action retaliation.
So in the Wisconsin Supreme Court case, where especially with Shiger, they said all you gave was an opinion, was there any dissent?
Yeah, the dissenting opinion talked about how this seemed to create an impossible standard for a person who wants to alert his or her bosses to problems, that if the bosses are the ones who are creating the problem or doing the behavior that this person is reporting, then it's impossible. You're telling the boss something that he or she already knows, and therefore you are not giving them whistleblower information. So it's just a very difficult. I'm not sure how a whistleblower would go forward under the scenario in which it was their direct supervisor, him or herself, who was actually doing the behavior that was being reported.
Insofar as you know, has there been any interest with our federal lawmakers to make this easier for, Wisconsin employees to blow the whistle?
Well, what we've had on the federal level is different activities having to do with federal employees. So people within the VA, for example, there's been some moves in Congress to better protect people who report problems within the VA, which is an agency that, as probably everybody knows, has had a lot of problems. The state whistleblower law specifically deals with state employees. And so it would be up to the state legislature to make changes if they want to in the law to make it more clear about what it is that a person needs to do to actually become a whistleblower who is protected from retaliation.
Dee, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Dee Hall is a co-founder of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism and serves as the managing editor. She joined us to talk about the center's new series, Broken Whistle, looking at the lack of protections for whistleblowers in Wisconsin.
First, Wisconsin's known for a lot of things. Cheese, other kinds of dairy, the Green Bay Packers, now the Foxconn deal, the Driftless region. The list just keeps going on and on. But for many people around the country, Wisconsin is known for its beer.
Beer is a huge part of both the state's economy and its history. And if you needed any more convincing, don't forget that our Major League Baseball team is called the Brewers. And our next guest is here to give us a guide to the state's best beer.
Kathy Flanagan joins us now. She's a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and author of the book Beer Lovers Wisconsin, Best Breweries, Brew Pubs, and Beer Bars. Kathy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
What led you to want to make this guide to the beers of Wisconsin?
Well, the Globe Pequot Publishers asked if I would write it, and I thought, yes. Yeah, I would. That would be great.
It was up your alley, though, right? This wasn't out of nowhere
right.
for you.
I write about beer for the Journal Sentinel, craft beer, and I started that about 4 years ago. And as part of that, we also have a listing online that it's an interactive. It lists all the breweries in the state. It's because it's a living, breathing thing, we can update it more often. But this way, I get to check out most of the breweries in person. So I did double duty.
So let's go a little bit further back. How did beer gain such a foothold in the state?
German immigrants, we have the perfect water setting. We have the perfect, you could go get ice. Lagering is pretty easy to do here because of the weather. There was barley then, there were hops then. It made sense.
So it was just sort of a natural fit for the immigrants coming to Wisconsin to make beer kind of the state drink.
Yeah, for a long time, Wisconsin grew its own barley and its own hops, and a hop blight eventually ended. The great number of hops farms, but it's growing back again. People are trying it one more time, and they're more resistant to the kinds of things that killed it off a long time ago. But also, I think John Gerda once told me, for people who were here as who came here as immigrants, they worked really hard. They worked long hours and they worked every day. And Sunday would be their day off, and beer was their drink of choice.
fast forwarding a bit, you know, once upon a time, it seems like there was a brewery in every town, lots of local beers to be had. Then the industry consolidated. There weren't as many choices. And now here we are again. We have all of these local craft breweries again, which is most of what your book is about. How did Wisconsin become such a haven for craft brewing?
Well, you know, Prohibition killed a lot of them. And then Madison, actually, I think, was the had more craft breweries than Milwaukee for a while. But Milwaukee did have among the first, Sprecher and then Lakefront, which turns 30 this year. And even Water Street Brewery, which also turns 30 this year. But then, you know, I think that same with the farm-to-table movement. People want their beer. They want to know where their beer is from. And mostly, they want to talk about their beer. Brewers and chefs are kind of the new rock stars. Breweries are kind of the new way we talk about things. Like as I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, you know, I saw the Police in 1978, you know, and I would say, I knew them before they were big. And you can do that about breweries and certain specific beers now.
So how has the craft brewing industry changed over the last 10 years or so now?
It's multiplied. I think we have 25 in Milwaukee now, and I would say even 7 years ago we had four. It's multiplied. And people enjoy going there. They enjoy meeting the brewer. There are different kinds of beers. I think the tastes of the public have changed so that they want something new and exciting, and they want the next big thing all the time. The Northeast is known for its juicy IPAs, which are not as hoppy and as bitter as the West Coast ones. And I think here in Wisconsin, they've developed their own sense of what an IPA should taste like, and we're getting more confident about our beers and the stature they have.
So, quick question. You know, the craft beer movement has really, really taken off over the last decade or so. You know, Wisconsin has a foothold, but of course, there are other states in the country that also claim that they have the best beer. Not that we want to pick sides here, but, you know, how does Wisconsin compare to, say, a Michigan, which is right across the lake?
I think Wisconsin is really at the point to be able to go toe-to-toe with Michigan. I mean, Michigan has a lot of beers, and I think that they have been organized a lot longer than Wisconsin in some ways. They took advantage of having so many craft beers. But I think that if you look at Wisconsin and you look at Central Waters and you look at New Glarus and Lakefront and Wisconsin Brewing and some of the regional breweries in the state that I'm going to forget and they're going to be mad at me, but they could go toe-to-toe, and I think we just need to take better advantage of showing people what's in the state. That was the fun part of the book. Small towns like Bloomer or Potosi have breweries, and, you know, you need to go there and visit them because their town, they keep them in business, but it's also kind of one of those fun finds. And, you know, Michigan's Pure Michigan campaign has done a lot to make us think about that with them. Plus they've also, what's it called when you just like jump on the bandwagon for their wines first, and then all the brewers took off from there. And I think we have those capabilities here, and certainly our beer is really pretty darn good.
We're talking to Kathy Flanagan right now. Her new book is Beer Lovers Wisconsin, Best Breweries, Brew Pubs, and Beer Bars. And Kathy, you break up your book by region. So let's take a look at least at a few of the regions around the state. Let's start in your backyard in Milwaukee. You said, over 30 craft brewers now. Take us through the beer scene there.
I think there are 25, I think I counted the other day. I was writing something on it. And they're really small ones like Urban Harvest, which is on 5th Street. 5th Street in Milwaukee has three breweries you can just walk to. One that used to be in Madison but found its footing here, Mobcraft, and then there's Brenner Brewing. And then there's Urban Harvest, which is it's a one-barrel brewery. It's really small, but it's got a big theater in the back of it, and they're really welcoming, and it's kind of sweet to go to. We have two breweries that are just out of the ordinary breweries in that one of them, 1840, ferments gets its wort from other brewers. It makes its wort at other brewers, and then it ferments it in barrels, and it's only open once a month. The other one, Like Mines, it does much the same. You can buy specialty brews once a week. That's how they do it. And then we have some more traditional breweries like Lakefront, which is known for its tours and its beer. And same with Milwaukee Brewing, which is moving into a huge new facility. So it keeps growing, and there are a couple of more on their way. I think the bulk of the growth was last year, but we'll see probably 3 or 4 more in the next 2 years.
Now, looking at Madison, which you said had the sort of the big craft beer resurgence, how is Madison, you know, playing a role right now?
Madison is continuing to grow, and I'm having trouble keeping up with it, to tell you the truth. I'm really lucky that for our beer near the list, the interactive list we do at the Journal Sentinel, people keep me informed. But, you know, Madison's had Wisconsin Brewing, and, you know, Capital Brewing has been around for a while, and Ale Asylum and Carbon 4, they're all really, really good. I think my biggest discovery last summer was Alt Beer, because they're the gluten-free beer, and it's delicious. I didn't realize I wouldn't miss gluten. And plus they've got a lot of growth going on there. And I think that they were the place that first discovered craft beer and first, in the way that it became the corner bar kind of craft beer brewery.
How about the Fox Cities area? You've got a whole section devoted to Oshkosh, Sheboygan, Appleton. So Fox Cities and beyond, I guess.
That, you know, as you can tell, that's growing as well. There are a couple, I love Three Sheeps in Sheboygan, and I think they're one of the bigger production breweries in that area. There are a number of really good beer bars in Sheboygan now. In Appleton, there are, you know, a couple of breweries to go to. I went to Bare Bones in Oshkosh, which you can see right off the freeway. And you get the idea, you get the sense that people really wanted something like this in their backyard. They want that ability to say they have a brewery in their town, in their hometown, and to take people to it. So I think that's what a lot of this is about. Same way you want a farm-to-table restaurant in your town, same way you want some fine dining. Another component of that is to have a brewery there.
So breweries are clearly becoming part of the community. Kathy Flanagan is with us now. She's a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and the author of Beer Lovers Wisconsin, Best Breweries, Brew Pubs, and Beer Bars. And we're talking beer right now on Central Time.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a recommendation of a great Wisconsin beer, maybe for the autumn season or any time of year, a favorite brewery in the state or a place to get beer? Or do you need a recommendation for the place you live, a place you're going to? I bet Kathy could help you out. Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Also call in if you're a brewer yourself. You can also email ideas@wpr.org.
We'll pick up that conversation after a quick break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we're continuing our conversation about beer, fall beers, the best breweries by region, and a whole lot more with Kathy Flanagan. She's a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and the author of Beer Lovers Wisconsin, Best Breweries, Brew Pubs, and Beer Bars.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite Wisconsin beer, your favorite Wisconsin brewery? Is there something you look forward to this time of year, or maybe a new one? Or do you need some recommendations, maybe for something in your backyard or when you're traveling around the state? Do you brew yourself at home or professionally? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
And we are going to go to our callers right now. Andy in Chippewa Falls, how are you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
So what is your brewery recommendation?
The brewery that I would recommend would be Oliphant Brewery over in Somerset, Wisconsin. They make a great beer called Honey's Honey. It's a peanut butter ale with lactose. It's fantastic.
Peanut butter?
Peanut
Did I hear
butter.
The words peanut butter and ale together?
Yeah.
How is that?
It's pretty good. The lactose kind of gives it a different mouthfeel, so it's pretty fantastic. I love it a lot.
I mean, that does sound really interesting. A peanut butter-based beer with lactose. Thank you so much for that call, Andy. So he's recommending Honey Honey from Oliphant in Somerset. And is that, Kathy, a brewery that you visited?
Excuse me, as I choked to death. Yes, it is. it was pretty fun. My daughter lives in Minneapolis, and so she went with me, and it's not very far from the border, and the place is just really funky. They have great artwork, and the owners are wonderful. At the time, I'm not sure they still have it, but they had a VHS room where everybody go in and sit on couches and watch old movies. I think Space Jam was playing the day I was in there.
For it.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call and the recommendation at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Michael in Onalaska. Michael, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you got for us, Michael?
Well, my recommendation is in La Crosse. It's on J Street, right next to the big bus grand station there. It's called Stolpe Steinhaus. It's the only German bar in La Crosse. And what's great about it, they've got a lot of taps available. You can sample different beers and see what you like. They got great food and $2.50 brats on Friday. So that's my recommendation.
Do you have a reserved stein there, Michael? Can you do that?
Yeah, it takes a while to get them. Okay. I haven't gotten mine yet, but I'm hoping.
You'll get those Packer season tickets before you get your stein there, right?
Yeah, you betcha.
Michael, thanks a lot. So there are a lot of these around the state, aren't there, Kathy? Kind of the German-style beer house with the steins hanging up and on from the ceiling.
Oh, there are a ton of them, and I wish I could have gone to all of them. When I was in La Crosse, I went to Turtle Stack, which is right by the river, and they have really delicious lagers. And I ran into Dave Anderson, another brewer there. He owns Dave's Brew Farm, which is in Wilson, and then also Pearl City's in La Crosse. So, the German beer halls are great. The places to get good German beer are sort of a staple of Wisconsin. And I don't think you can do that in just any old state.
And we have an email from Nola. She recommends Hillsboro Brewing Company. She said that they visited and enjoyed 6 different craft beers, and she recommends Big Jim as an awesome dark beer. So a couple of things. First, of course, you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And, you know, she's recommending a dark beer, and we are getting into fall right now, and that's kind of the dark beer season. Are you familiar with that brewing company? And, you know, maybe we should start thinking about some warmer beers for the cooler temperatures.
I do know Hillsboro. They're so nice. Ran into them at Dell's on Tap a couple weeks ago, and it is. I sort of do. You know, I don't make beer, and I'm only still learning about beer. But before, when I was a wine drinker, white wine was summer, red wine was winter, and I feel that way about lighter beers in summer, and now move into porters and stouts. And I think that that's pretty common, especially when you consider there are a lot of Black Friday releases. They're going to be more this year. Lakefront has its stout. I'm not going to be able to say it right, but Russian Imperial Stout. It releases on Black Friday, and a couple of other places are doing that. Third Space in Milwaukee just released its Mocha Java Porter, which, is kind of that stuff that makes you feel warm and cozy and sort of tastes like cocoa, and you can imagine yourself raking the lawn and then going in and drinking it and sitting by a fire. That's what it's all about. That's what porters are like this time of year.
We're talking to Kathy Flanagan from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Her new book is called Beer Lovers Wisconsin, Best Breweries, Brew Pubs, and Beer Bars. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Kyle is with us in Dodgeville. Kyle, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What do you have for us, or do you have a question?
I had a question. I was wondering what you guys like for Oktoberfest style of beer.
Kathy, any good Oktoberfest beers?
I really like Staghorn from New Glarus, and I also, Tyranina makes a good Oktoberfest. I'm not the hugest Oktoberfest fan there is. My husband is. I like them, but they're not my favorite style.
All right. Hope that helps you out, Kyle.
Sorry.
That's okay. No, that's, you got 2 concrete suggestions there. I'm all for it. You mentioned the friendliness, Kathy, and something you mentioned in your book, actually, is that a lot of brewers are really eager to help introduce new people to brewing, which seems kind of counterintuitive. You're training potentially your competition, but it seems like there's really a good spirit of helping each other out.
Yeah, I hear this phrase, the rising tide lifts all boats phrase all the time. I think there is there's a they help each other, and it makes sense because it's I guess you could, the analogy would be a mall. When you're in a mall, you don't stop shopping at one store. You like to see what's in the different stores. If there are breweries near each other, you like to see what the different breweries do. Nobody does it exactly the same way. So helping each other only builds up the business and only builds up the talk about the business of beer. So they do seem to be, you know, pretty nice to each other, sharing yeast, working together. Several brewers in Milwaukee have a group that has events once a month together, and people are invited to come and try everybody else's beer. It makes sense. It sort of promotes beer in and of itself.
So, I mean, as you said earlier, Kathy, there are a lot of breweries in the state, and it seems like there are some that just keep opening, they keep popping up. For people who are enthusiastic or who want to learn more about Wisconsin breweries, how can they, you know, maybe get involved before they get overwhelmed by just the sheer number in the state?
You know, you can start small and you can go to a festival. Unfortunately, much of the festival season has ended for this year. It'll get started. There'll be a couple more, but it'll get started again in February, and then it goes. And I think at festivals, you can try different beers in small amounts. But if you go, I mean, more and more taverns and bars have all different kinds of craft beer, which is not something that's been the later development of all this. And if you go in and you can either ask for a sample or get a sampler platter, that way you don't have to order, you know, a pint of a beer that you think you won't like. You can try them a little bit. If you don't like sours, I encourage you to try them in small amounts because they're really good. But never judge a beer by the first taste. Always have at least two, because I think that's the only way you're going to know if you like it or not for sure.
Let's go to another caller now. Kurt is on the line in Green Bay. Kurt, hi.
Hi, how are you guys? So a couple of breweries in the Green Bay area would be Copper State and Titletown. They're right across from each other, and they both have some beautiful flavors. I just want to say that, you know, we love stouts and porters year-round. So, that's part of the reason that we love the craft breweries. We also love the ambiance and also the conversations that you get and the differences between the age groups. So one other brewery I just want to mention is the Anapi Brewery, which is up in Algoma, and they have a couple of brews, Little Soldier out there and another one called Two Stall. Great flavored beers, but I recommend just going out and trying anywhere and anywhere. So I mean, try them all.
Kurt, thank you so much for calling in. And Kathy, that reminds me, and a couple of those are in Kurt's backyard, but beer and brewery and brewpub tourism is definitely more and more of a thing in Wisconsin. And you actually give some suggestions there. Share a couple ideas with us.
Well, you know, he mentioned Copper State, which is moved into the building that used to be Hinterland. And I haven't been able to get up there yet, and I really, really want to, because I watched them go through a program here called Barley to Barrel. And so I heard their ideas for Copper State, and they sounded fabulous. You know, that's part of it is you find a section of town. Green Bay, for instance, has a lot of breweries, and you could do them all in a weekend. If you get up there and you're going to a Packer game, go ahead and pick three to go to and then three others. Going to a brewery doesn't mean you have to get drunk. It just means you have to try their beer. And then you'll know if you go to a store later and you see cans or bottles what to get.
And that's a good place to leave it. Thanks to Kathy Flanagan. She's a reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We've been talking about her new book, Beer Lovers Wisconsin, Best Breweries, Brew Pubs, and Beer Bars. You can still share your favorites. Why don't you tweet us at Central Time WPR.
A new online post was so wildly popular that it crashed the server it was being posted on.
But it wasn't a funny cat video or a hot take on the latest social trend or even a recipe.
It was a PhD thesis in astronomy by, drumroll, Stephen Hawking.
Cambridge University made the 1966 thesis available to the public for free online viewing at midnight GMT this morning, actually 1 second after midnight. The title of the thesis, This is a hot seller.
Oh, yeah.
Properties of expanding universes.
And according to the BBC, there was so much response that the Cambridge website crashed on and off throughout the day. I mean, who else can say that they're paper,
PhD
paper crashed a website.
Yeah, so for some comparative numbers, you know, the top YouTube videos of all time have like a billion views or whatever. 60,000 here. That's a lot for, you know, what, one day, not even, when this number came out. That was enough to overwhelm Cambridge University. I mean, yeah, that is, and it's not, you know, hot pop song video levels of interest. But a lot of interest.
But it's interesting.
For a PhD
I think people
thesis.
Want to see what he wrote and what made him famous.
I kind of want to look at it myself. Will I comprehend it?
Yeah, I know
maybe
that
not.
I won't.
I need the Cliff's Notes version.
Exactly.
Maybe
I needed like one page.
I guess he wrote a book actually that was the Cliff's Notes version of his research. I should just start there.
There you go.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.